Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Literary Studies, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Miranda Corcoran and joining me today is Lizette Lopez-Swidke, author of Transmedia Adaptation in the 19th Century. So Lizette, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So before we begin to talk about your book, could you tell us a little bit more about your background and your research interests?
Yeah, I think so. I am currently a newly associate professor of English at the University of Arkansas, where I've taught for the last 7 years. I'm also associate director for the Arkansas Humanities Center. I've been working, my areas of expertise and specialization are 19th century British literature and gender studies, and also adaptation studies. A part of the reason why I'm really interested in the growing interdisciplinary field of adaptation studies is that I think that it's a wonderful way of bringing literary history and bringing a lot of the topics in the humanities that are important to all of us working in these fields to a broader audience. And a lot of my work kind of strives for that, to kind of bridge the academy and, the public audiences, and also interdisciplinary discussions. And so that's really a bit about me and my interests.
Thank you. So to start with, could you tell us a little bit more about transmedia, particularly transmedia adaptation? What does that term mean and where does it come from?
I think so. Transmedia adaptation is a term that I think is used mostly in contemporary media studies. The scholar whose work I read that has kind of influenced my thoughts mostly about transmedia adaptation is Henry Jenkins, who's published many works on convergence culture and transmedia storytelling. I take a little bit of a different approach than he does. So I'll tell you briefly what he sees transmedia adaptation as is in contemporary storytelling, especially in the convergence of the media into separate media industries. Transmedia adaptation becomes the elastic nature of storytelling, where you have a version of a story will come out in a book that gets translated or adapted into film, and then you have any number of extensions, reimaginings, prequels, sequels that may cross multiple media platforms. So you have not just television and film, which is what we usually think about when we think about adaptation, but we see the same, franchises expanding into comic books, into video games, into all kinds of different media, and you have these audiences that go to all of these different media, or some of them maybe just kind of focus on one medium, but you have basically a story or a story world that's available across different media platforms. And so that's a really kind of key way of thinking about adaptation in our contemporary moment. If we think about big franchises like Star Wars or the Avengers or the DC comic book universe, you have, you know, a story world that's unfolding constantly over multiple platforms, over multiple forms. So I use that idea to think about storytelling historically. Like I said before, I'm a 19th century literature specialist. And so my focus is the way that stories were retold and dispersed and repackaged across forms and media in the time before cinema. So before we have the adaptation of books into films, we have the adaptation of books into stage adaptations and maybe abridgments and all other kinds of products, painting, illustration. So that's the way that I'm seeing the term. One of the reasons, the major difference is the forms, right, and the media that's available in terms of adaptation. Those do differ quite a bit in the 18th and 19th century to, you know, compared to the present day. But there are other kind of reasons why the practice was a little bit different, and I'm sure I'll get a chance to talk about that in a bit. But I'm thinking about this same concept, the way it worked historically, and the way it worked a little bit more dispersed than it does now. So now you have, you know, a corporate entity often kind of taking control of a lot of the way that these transmedia adaptations unfold, right? They're marketed in a very kind of intentional way. That was different in the 19th century because you didn't have the same kind of corporate involvement. But the practice itself, the interest in doing it, that has been pretty consistent over time. And that's what this book is about.
Okay, thank you. So you note in the introduction that modern audiences often associate adaptation with modern blockbusters like The Avengers or Harry Potter, even though it was a common practice in the 18th and 19th centuries. So what did it mean to adapt a work in the 19th century? What kind of works were adapted? And how did this practice differ from modern cinematic adaptations?
Okay, so I think I would say that, you know, for me, the practice is very similar and almost identical to contemporary cinematic adaptations and contemporary transmedia storytelling, with the biggest difference being that the ownership of, you know, who owns an adaptation, that was a very different context. And actually, it was the 19th century context that led us to the contemporary franchise model, where over debates about copyright. So I have quite a bit of discussion about specifically Charles Dickens and his relationship to watching his books get adapted without being credited to him, often while he was still writing them, since he was publishing them as serialized novels. And you get several examples of where, I mean, most of his novels started getting adapted for the stage, even, you know, when they were only like a third or halfway through the serial, the run. So people are adapting his works and he hasn't even finished writing them yet. The idea of copyright is the major difference from contemporary the contemporary context, but otherwise it was very similar. And so you had both old works getting adapted into new formats, and you had contemporary works getting also adapted very quickly. So I can give you two brief examples that I discuss in the book. And so one of them, for example, is you have in the late Victorian period, you have this kind of reemergence of the Camelot stories. And so Tennyson largely kicks that off with his own interest in the Arthurian tradition. But you have so many different poets and dramatists and painters getting really interested in adapting these stories from Camelot. And that's an example of kind of an old set of stories, right, from the medieval tradition that get completely repackaged and reimagined and modernized for Victorian audiences. So you have this practice of taking older works, this is true also of Shakespeare's works and how they circulate in the 19th century, and giving them a modern face. So very similar to the practice today of like the interest in kind of neo-Victorianism. It's one of the points I make in the book is that this practice of Victorian medievalism is how it's called by specialists. This interest in adapting stories from the past and modernizing them becomes kind of reimagined again in the contemporary moment, where you have so much interest in Jane Austen and the Gothic novels of the 19th century, and specifically kind of period pieces. So that's one form of storytelling that happens in the 19th century, is the repackaging of old stories for new audiences. But you also have the same phenomenon happening with books that were just coming out. So for example, one of the books and one of the stories that I tend to kind of default to quite a bit is Frankenstein, because I mean, it's one of my areas, it's one of the texts that I know the most and I teach the most, and really well versed in its history. But it's a really great example because people know Frankenstein. I mean, just about anybody knows Frankenstein, even 4-year-olds. If you walk into a room full of 4-year-olds and you say, "Hey, what do you know about Frankenstein?" They all have these ideas, even though, of course, none of them are old enough to have any familiarity with Mary Shelley and her novel. And that's because we have this long history of adaptation, and that history began almost immediately for Frankenstein. So Mary Shelley publishes the book in 1818, and in 1823, we have it become a stage hit, basically. And so that's an example of a newer novel that almost immediately gets adapted for the stage and then circulates primarily via a number of different stage adaptations in the 1820s. You have between England and France, we know that there were at least 15 different stage versions of Frankenstein that came out in the 1820s. And that is by far the primary way that the story is circulated in the 1820s, and then continued to circulate. And that's the way it continues. It remains like the primary mode of circulation for the Frankenstein story. So those are two major differences, forms or examples of what was getting adapted. It was both old works and new works. But the major difference was not so much that they were being adapted or that they were being changed significantly, because that's something that people ask me quite a bit too, is, well, were they changing or were they trying to be faithful to the text? And it's like, no, they weren't trying to be faithful at all. On the contrary, sometimes you get, you know, comedy, you know, farces based on Frankenstein when it's obviously not a funny book at all. So there was no attempt at fidelity at all. It's a concept that's very much an idea that I think contemporary scholars like to talk a lot about when they talk about adaptation, but it's not really the way that the people who were actually doing the adaptations and working on these adaptations thought about adaptation. And the biggest difference then was who owns it. And back in the 19th century, basically the idea was that if you adapted a work into a new format, then you owned it. You didn't have to credit the author. And so sometimes you do get the authors credited in some shape or form, but in the 19th century, it was kind of a free-for-all. And that's a major difference to where we are today.
So you note in your book that with this project, you really wanted to flip the script on how scholars understand adaptations, rather than reading adaptations as derivative works or as part of the afterlife of the original text. You see the practice as essential to textual production and the endurance of literary works. Can you tell us a bit more about why you chose to approach adaptation in this manner?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's really what's at the heart of my interest in adaptation. So I think that a lot of times what we see, not so much in adaptation studies, but definitely with literary scholars, is that you see, well, you have this book, and this book is so great. And the reason why this book is so great, or one of the ways that we can prove that this book is so great, is that it's been adapted over and over and over again. And what I have been able, from what I can tell, in, you know, from my research, and I've been working on this book for a very, very long time, you know, it's over a decade's worth of research and kind of thinking about these ideas, is that, well, you know, what if you take the opposite approach? Like, what if you say, well, this is a quote unquote great work of literature, and it's a complicated and loaded term, but let's just go with that for a second. If you look at the cultural histories of any of these big books that are like really well known, what you see is that they have these very long standing histories of adaptation that in many ways created, right, or forged the path forward for that book to become so well known. Frankenstein is a great example of this. When it's published originally in 1818, it's published anonymously, and it has 500 copies published. And that's it. I mean, it wasn't a book that got great reviews. A lot of people actually trashed it. It was seen as immoral by some people. It was just seen as, you know, not good writing. It was, you know, seen as too gothic, too political, too. There was plenty of things that people critiqued it for. And there's a version of this where, you know, the book, like many other books, just kind of falls into obscurity. Or the story does. And what ends up happening is that when it gets adapted in 1823, Mary Shelley's father, William Godwin, who is, you know, a scholar and a public intellectual and, you know, a writer and a philosopher and all of these, you know, great things in his own right, tells her, hey, this is a great time to put out another edition of Frankenstein and see if this stage version is popular, then maybe, you know, you can sell more books. And he personally oversees an edition that comes out in 1823, where now 1,500 copies of the book are in circulation. So it basically, you know, that adaptation prompts a quadrupling of the available number of copies in print. And so that alone is significant. What I find even more fascinating, though, is that especially with some of the bigger adaptations and like Presumption or The Fate of Frankenstein, which is like the big blockbuster of 1823, is that on any given night when you went to the theater, 2,000 people could be watching this story. Or so 2,000 or so people could be watching this story on stage. And so when you start thinking about that exponentially, how many people are experiencing this story per night, 2,000 per night. And it's like at that point, 2,000, there's only 2,000 copies of the book in print at all. So you start to see that the thing that's really kind of moving Frankenstein forward, this ends up happening to be the case also with a lot of Dickens's works, or most of them, with a lot of other writers from the period. What starts to really propel them forward is that they're being adapted so many times that the story continues to gain interest. It becomes like a form of publicity. But it also means that a lot of people are only consuming. Like it does sell books, but not everybody who watches a movie today goes out and reads the book. But it does kind of, the relationship, it's an interrelated kind of phenomenon. There's not one thing or the other that becomes more important. Literary scholars may think that the book, right, is more important, but you know, if you're working in the film industry, or if you're an actor, or if you're, you know, you work on the stage, like that's not the most interesting format of a story. And so what I'm interested in this book is kind of tracking that and showing, hey, you know, we should probably, as literary scholars, we should probably be thinking more about adaptation. We should be thinking more and supporting it, right? Thinking about, okay, if I really want a book to make a big cultural impact, then the thing I should be doing is hoping and encouraging people to adapt it, right? To create new forms of it, to engage with it critically. And so that's really like at the heart of my approach to thinking about adaptation is not that, you know, these are, they're these secondary or derivative works, but that they're works that are in conversation with the original, and that they are works that, you know, if they disappear, basically what you see is a disappearance of the importance of the original work, at least culturally, like maybe not to literary historians, but to the kind of the culture at large, or, you know, the modern period, right? So I think a really great example of this, and I'll be really brief, is that, you know, the novels of Sir Walter Scott in the Romantic period, and throughout, like, till the late 19th century, they were among the most adapted works. There are hundreds of stage adaptations of all of Scott's novels. And what you start to see in the 20th century is less of an interest, declining interest in the novels of Scott. Not because Scott's works are any less relevant or any less good by whatever, you know, standards you want to judge them by, but there just seems to be less interest. And so what you end up also seeing is if you teach the 19th century and you teach novels, how many people teach Scott? That number is decreasing, and you start to see kind of a less of a cultural imprint. You know, if you walk into a room full of 4-year-olds, you know, they may not be able to tell you anything about Ivanhoe, right? But they will tell you something about Frankenstein. And that's the thing that it's that relationship that I'm just really, really excited about. And I think that needs to be explored more, both by literary historians, and then also by people working in contemporary film and media studies and adaptation scholars, because you don't usually see these groups in conversation very much.
In your book, then, you describe the 19th century as a period when commercial and literary adaptation proliferated, particularly on the stage. What was it about this period that was so conducive to the practice of adaptation?
Yeah. So one of the things that I discuss in the book is that, you know, by the time you're getting into the second half of the 18th century and the first half of the 19th century, what you really start to see is this cultural shift around the idea of the arts and artistic production as there's a big, like, economic shift. So what was usually supported through patronage, right, through kind of wealthy support and donations, becomes increasingly a commercial endeavor. And so you have, you know, the rise of commercialism plays a huge role in the proliferation of adaptation. Again, there are examples of adaptation. You can go back to, you know, classical, you know, Greek works, right? You could think about, for example, you know, mythology as a form, you know, in all of the forms that it takes as a form of transmedia adaptation. But what really changes in the late 18th century is the rise of commercialism. And so as industries emerge, right, as profitable or profit-driven enterprises, you see these industries really trying to figure out what's going to make the most money. And being able to have an item that's recognizable in some shape or form becomes a form of marketing, right, as a form of creating demand for a particular kind of story. And so I think that that's a really big, you know, part of what happens. There's a second part too, and the second part is largely political. And so what you have in the late 18th century is, you know, the rise of democratic movements in the United States, or what becomes the United States, in France, in you know, across the world. One of the things that happens is that politically, the idea that all of these literary forms or artistic forms, so literature, visual arts, drama, that all of these forms and modes of storytelling should be largely accessible to a wide readership. I mean, before that, you're talking about, major works of art would be held in private collections. And what you have instead at this moment politically is you have the rise of the art gallery, for example. And so how do you get, a larger audience interested in coming to visit an art gallery? Well, one way to do it is to, advertise it as we're going to create this, we're going to, show you a lot of paintings based on Shakespeare's plays, right? And so that becomes a commercial driven enterprise, but one that's also very kind of culturally grounding. So, people who maybe those people went to go see Shakespeare's plays, maybe they didn't, maybe they just wanted to go hang out at the art gallery because it was very fashionable at the time, but they're experiencing the story somehow. And so it becomes a time where this convergence of like the rise of commercialism, the rise of democratic movements that are about bringing literature and art to a larger audience. These are two of the main conditions that really kind of propel this practice of adaptation that really creates it into a commercial endeavor. The third point that I would bring in there, which is an example, and I also discuss this in the book, is that you have the technological shifts, right? The 19th century is known largely as being the age of industrialization. And so one of the things you have the ability to print new editions, right? A printing becomes much more affordable as the century moves forward. And then you also have the introduction of illustrated editions. And so what you end up with, I have a chapter in the book that is about the visual arts. And specifically, if you are an artist, a visual artist during the time, one of the things, and even today to a certain extent, but definitely during this time, one of the things that you would do and to make your name is, adapt visually or illustrate the work of either a well-known older writer or a new writer. And so you see publishers really interested in selling these new illustrated editions and artists really interested in getting in on, this is a way to get my artwork out there. And there are those three, I think that the convergence of those three different, very different historical contexts really is the thing that drives the adaptation industry in the 19th century. And what it ends up doing is kind of creating a blueprint for how adaptation continues to evolve in the 20th and 21st centuries.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Okay, I actually wanted to pick up on an earlier point you made there about the changing nature of the arts, the idea that the arts are becoming more commercial and less dependent on patronage. They're becoming, like I said, a more commercial endeavor. So what did the term celebrity mean in the context of the 19th century? How did adaptation contribute to the growth of celebrity culture at this time?
Yeah, thanks. So, it's a great question. I think one that, there are so many different ways that you can take you can address that, the rise of celebrity. But you know, one of the things that I think makes a celebrity is like is their recognizability, right? They have to be a celebrity, you have to be, people have to recognize you. And so the way that that gets built in the 19th century is through a number of different avenues, but it's like this idea of repetition is really, really central to it. So, you know, for literary historians, specifically ones who work in the period that I do, you know, Byron is known as being kind of one of the first, if not probably the first, literary celebrity. And so I discuss him in the book. And largely what you see Byron, you know, partly on of his own accord, but partly other people doing it, is kind of driving this idea. And I'm going to give you a different version of the Byronic hero this time. And I'm going to give you a different version, you know, here. But there's going to be something that clearly ties all of these versions together, some kind of repetition. And you start to see his face and his character, or his own kind of personal history getting blended in with his characters, with each version, right, that gets circulated. And so that is part of what's building his celebrity during the time. But this is not something that's just for literary celebrities. So stage celebrities, actors, actresses, they have these kind of original plays that they might, you know, participate in. But really, if you look at a lot of the most well-known actors of the 19th century, they are making a name for themselves by putting a new spin on Shakespeare's characters. So you take an older work and you modernize it. And so we're going to see, what's Sarah Siddons' version, right, of Shakespeare? You know, what is Ellen Terry's, later in the Victorian period, version of Shakespeare? And so that becomes a way of driving celebrity too. One of the more interesting examples that I give in the book is this American actor, Richard Mansfield, who reads Jekyll and Hyde, The Strange Case of Jekyll and Hyde, which is published in 1886. He reads it and he's like, immediately, this needs to go on stage and I want to play Jekyll and Hyde. And so he gets a version on the stage about 6 months or so after Jekyll and Hyde is published. So it's very quick. And he becomes, I mean, this character basically makes his career. And he starts touring, playing Jekyll and Hyde. He spends a lot of time in London playing Jekyll and Hyde. And people are just really fascinated by it. And so I have an example there. He, you know, sold calendars of him and all of his characters. And most of these are characters based on books in some shape or form. And so that becomes a way of building his own brand, building his own celebrity. And you see it to a lesser extent too. So you have authors, you have actors, and you see a bit of lesser extent in the adapters themselves. So there are quite a few writers or dramatists in the 19th century who just become really well known for adapting works, and they become kind of go-to people. This becomes part of their repertoire, and they're very prolific in this work because that's their main job. It's just to adapt works. And so they build their professional identities around this idea of being professional adapters and knowing how to carefully craft a book or take a book and make it into something that people want to see, not just read. So there were lots of different ways that idea of celebrity happened. But I mean, again, if you really kind of think about what is a celebrity, this idea of being easily recognizable, like what does it mean to become an icon? You have to be repeated over and over and over and over again to the point that everyone can recognize you in some shape or form. And the only way that that happens is through that process of repetition, which is, you know, very much tied into the practice of adaptation.
In addition to discussing theatrical adaptation, you also look at adaptation, the visual arts, painting, illustration, engraving, and so on. What role did these artists play in the adaptation of literary sources? and how do their works shape the reception of these literary texts?
Yeah, that's a great question, because you know, one of the things that a lot of times what we don't realize when we're thinking about the visual arts is just how much the visual arts have always been indebted to some kind of adaptation. And in the 18th and 19th century, the practice of kind of historic painting, which was kind of the most academic and most kind of fine art form of painting, always relied on, you know, the kind of visualizing of figures, biblical figures, figures from classical mythology, and literary figures. This is like the, you know, a lot of what the subjects of these paintings are. And so one of the things that people sometimes maybe like don't really think too much about is, well, what is the role here in kind of shaping the work and shaping the reception of the work? Because we think about it, if we think about these illustrations as, oh, we're just going to take a book and copy it faithfully, then we're really ignoring that the visual artists who are participating are also interpreters. Right. In many ways, they are also scholars and critics, because they are taking their own, they're putting their own spin on what they read, what they imagine, what they read. And sometimes kind of they insert their own political viewpoints into that piece as they're shaping it. So they played a large role in many ways, but they also often changed the way that the text was received. So I think that one really great example that we don't think about, because we don't think of him as a commercial success because he was not in his time, but William Blake is a figure who shows up in this book as an adapter, as a visual adapter. And you see his illustrations, for example, of Dante, or his illustrations of Milton, in particular, of Paradise Lost, as really participating in the kind of cultural reimagining of these older works, and specifically of Milton, because, you know, the Romantics, for those of us who study that period, we know that the Romantics were really fascinated with Milton's Paradise Lost, but they are fascinated in not reclaiming Milton necessarily on his own terms, but kind of reformatting and adapting Milton to fit their own political their own political ideas based in their own contemporary moment. So, you know, William Blake and Percy Shelley, you know, famously see Satan, for example, as like one of the most fascinating poetic figures in Paradise Lost. And you see that definitely coming through in Blake's illustrations, Blake, his engravings for Paradise Lost, where he, you know, he envisions Satan as this very beautiful, seductive figure in a number of, you know, in ways that really kind of ask us to critically engage with the tradition itself. You see this happening also later in the 19th century as women begin to illustrate works. So one of the examples, again, I come back to Camelot in one of the chapters, because I'm really interested in how late 19th century women visual artists like Margaret Cameron really come in and kind of put their own spin on works and kind of really focus on the women characters of the story world. And they're doing that because they are identifying with those characters and not happy with the way that they have been portrayed. So Julia Margaret Cameron ends up doing this. She's one of the early kind of big photographers in the Victorian period. And she does this kind of series of photographic illustrations and, you know, in conversation with Tennyson himself. And you see her kind of reimagining these women as these more sympathetic figures. And you see that really happening, continuing to happen later on in the earliest 20th century with illustrators like Jessie King, who really kind of take a completely different view of figures like Guinevere and see her as a largely sympathetic figure. And that those are definitely contemporary readings, right? This is definitely something that happens, you know, in tandem with the rise of the idea of the new woman and early feminist movements. And so the role that the visual artists play in shaping these texts is really big, especially as the demand for reprints is often kind of tied to a demand for illustrated editions. And so what they're doing is basically serving as visual interpreters and critics and shaping the reception of the work along the way.
So in the fourth chapter, you discuss the idea of story worlds, such as the one created by Charles Dickens and his later adapters. So what is a story world? Why did they thrive in the 19th century? And how do these aggregate worlds anticipate the modern idea of the shared cinematic universe?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is exactly what I was thinking when I was writing that chapter, is that, or when I really started to think about, well, what is the parallel? And most of the book does that, takes like a contemporary idea and says, well, what's its 19th century kind of equivalent? And so the modern idea of the shared cinematic universe is, I think, very much anticipated by what we would otherwise maybe call mythology in some ways. I think that the idea of a story world is really helpful in this, because what you start to see in the 18th and 19th centuries and the way that adaptations start to work is that it's not just a one-to-one relationship. It's not just, okay, here I am a dramatist or I am a visual artist and I'm going to go back to this original text and I'm going to reproduce it faithfully. What you see instead is that whoever this new adapter is and whatever form they are taking to adapt the work, what they're doing is thinking not only about that original text, but also thinking about, well, who else has adapted this work? What have they thought about it? And what you start to see is like these aggregations of adaptations. And so I think that that becomes key. Like what you start to see is that it's not just the story that the original author wanted, or whoever the original author, sometimes it's even more complicated than that, but let's say if you're talking about a specific book that something is based on, it's not about reproducing that book entirely, but maybe completely reimagining different alternative endings, right? Different alternative ways that the story could have unfolded. You start to think of, you know, the backstory for characters might be different, so you have this kind of modern idea of the prequel could be kind of added into this too. And so what you start to see is you have a version of the story populated by characters, and it becomes the characters, not necessarily the plots, that are the source of the new adaptations. And so I think that the idea of story worlds, especially the way we think of transmedia story worlds today, where, you know, we're going to have the Marvel cinematic universe, and we're going to have, you know, some films that have the stories of, you know, the Avengers, a bunch of them together, but they're also going to have their offshoot movies, right, where they get to go on their own adventures. You see a version of that happening, and that's especially true with again, like an example like Camelot, where you can write the backstories to characters who never got to get stories before, especially the women characters. You start to see a much bigger interest in them. And so one of the reasons, for example, why I keep talking about Camelot, not the Arthurian tradition, is like, I like this idea of thinking about the stories of Camelot, because Camelot kind of places it in an imaginary world that is, you know, where it's not King Arthur, right? It's not Arthur who's the center of that world, but it's this place, and that all of these characters are moving in and out of this place, this imagined place, and that each one of the characters has stories of their own to tell. Is basically this idea that was grounding my argument in this fourth chapter. And then you also have a kind of another version of that. So that's the older version. And the newer version in the 19th century is this idea of Dickens, right? And Dickens, how is he remembered? He's remembered primarily through his characters and his characters moving through Victorian London. And I think that continues to be the case today, especially you have the show Dickensian, right, which is a mashup of basically all of or about a dozen of Dickens's novels. And it's just like all of these characters, these memorable characters from different novels coming together into this new story, to tell this new story in this kind of neo-Victorian story world. So I think that, again, when you start to really think about, well, what is the practice that's driving these decisions and these formats, you start to see that they have a historical precedent, and one that goes really far back. You know, you could write a book called Transmedia Adaptation in the Early Modern Period. It would look a little bit different than the book that I wrote, but there would still be elements of this that you could still trace back then. And I hope that there's a Shakespearean out there who wants to, you know, write that book, or someone who specializes more in the medieval tradition who will write that book. It's going to look a little bit different, but that kind of foundational practice of wanting to repeat these stories, wanting to take these characters on new adventures, wanting to reimagine, wanting to modernize them, and sometimes wanting to like completely rewrite and critique that original version. These are all practices that you see different variations of them happening at different historical moments.
So one thing I really loved in your book was your discussion of tie-ins and merchandising in the 19th century. What kind of souvenirs and collectibles were produced at the time? What was the relationship to the source material? And who would have bought these kinds of tie-ins and why?
Yeah, that's a great question. And this is where you really start to see the practice of adaptation as a truly commercial endeavor in the 19th century. So, because I mean, you could make the case that, well, you know, the play, they're trying to create art, and they are trying to create art. But the theater managers are also trying to sell tickets. But then there's the existence of all of these other artifacts that start to really uncover how much of a commercial practice this was. So in the book, the two that I focus on are the first are like these kind of pulp abridgments that, you know, are just really fascinating in their own right. But you can tell that they are sometimes like Gothic mashups of a bunch of different sources. So in 1825, there's this series of Endless Entertainment. The series is called Endless Entertainment, and it really is a precursor to like the science fiction magazines of the 1920s and 30s, these pulp fiction and detective fiction magazines. But this Endless Entertainment series is a series of adaptations, and there's a Frankenstein version, and you can tell when you read it that it's adapting both parts. I mean, there's a familiarity with Mary Shelley, but it's also reimagining or adapting the work through the lens of its adaptations. And so, like I had said before, the big adaptation of 1823 was called Presumption. And so the word presumption shows up so many times in this abridgment. It's this pulp kind of a magazine. And so the creature is speaking and he's saying, I am the danger of thy presumption. And you can tell that this is completely channeling the stage version. Even the way that little pulp adaptation, this pulp fiction adaptation ends is, you know, with an avalanche, which is basically the way that Presumption, the stage version, ended. There is no avalanche. I mean, there's definitely the Arctic in at the end of Mary Shelley's novel, but there's no avalanche. And so you could tell that the writer here is being influenced primarily by the stage version, and then there's kind of a secondary interest in the original novel. So it's not really about that at all. It's about selling this, you know, magazine, which is a series. And so you can tell there that this is very much like, you know, today you could buy, a comic book version of of a film. And it's basically its parallel in the 19th century. The other one, though, that people get really, really interested in, and I find really interesting as well, are these toy theaters. As I talk about them extensively in this chapter, and there's a lot more work to be done on these artifacts. But basically, toy theaters were these miniature versions of the contemporary stage. And so they started off in the early 19th century as just theatrical souvenirs. And, you know, so you would go in and you would see your favorite actors. And when you come out of the theater, you know, across the street, you can go to the bookseller and buy a print, you know, of your favorite actor, you know, in whatever costume they were wearing. And so, they start to become what were like these full page prints start to become miniaturized. And eventually children start to get really interested in these items as collectibles. And so what I do in the second half of the chapter that I discuss, the toy theater phenomenon, is really kind of go through the history of like how it emerged. And that's based on other research that is out there, but with a different focus. And one of the things I was looking at is like, well, so many of the stories, so they start to sell these full theatrical sets. So it's not just, it starts off being like, geez, one print of an actor, then like, oh, here's the entire cast. And then they start to get driven by this idea of like, well, we need to kind of attach them to something. So we're going to also include kind of a child-friendly adaptation of the play, so that kids can play with this and kind of reenact these stories. And so Shakespeare's works are really popular. Scott's works are very popular at the time, and almost all of Scott's books or novels at the time that get adapted for the stage have a toy version or toy theater version of them that's available. And you know, it's really exciting to me to think about this, because what I started to see in these adaptations, or what I started to see in these adaptations, is that they are very much not based on the original works, at least not in the way that we think of it. They're based on these contemporary stage versions of the works. And so you start to have these items, and again, this is just one example, because I talk a lot about the kind of the rise of children's media here too, and children's culture, where, you know, these sets were a way to engage younger audiences, some of whom, you know, may not have been, you know, attending the plays at all, maybe some of them who weren't interested in reading. But that this was like a form of play that was engaging, and it was a way to kind of inspire creativity. And I have a colleague, Jonathan Ray Lee, who works actually on contemporary Lego and games, and he's made the case that these 19th century toy theaters are very similar to the way that we think of Legos today, where you know, you can go out and buy Lego sets that are based on, these are, you know, licensed merchandise that are based on the DC universe, the Marvel universe. You can buy Harry Potter Legos. You can, you know, and so it's kind of the same idea. And it's this idea that you can have this open-ended play on one end, an open-ended use, but that you have these characters that you love and that you want, you know, just like you would want your Harry Potter minifig in, you know, today, or at least maybe 10-year-olds would, or, you know, lots of adults too, that the 19th century child would also be interested in, you know, this open-ended play with these, you know, toys that were based on, again, now stories that were seen as important enough to kind of, to reproduce in this format. You see a lot of fairy tales being issued as toy theater collections as well. And all of these fairy tales also had their stage versions that were circulating at the time. So I think that those are some, like, that's just a really great example. There are plenty of other items too. Sarah Meir has done some really great work in documenting like the phenomenon that was Uncle Tom's Cabin in the mid-19th century, and specifically as a commercial phenomenon. And you see, you know, different types of souvenirs and things like cigarette cards, which, you know, they're like baseball, like trading cards today. It's a very similar kind of phenomenon. It looks a little bit different because it's the 19th century version of it. But, you know, you have people who are become collectors, basically. And so there's basically what you start to see in this 19th century commercial environment is people coming in and saying, well, how can we market this to children? How can we market this to adults? How can we market, you know, just different audiences? What would they like to see? And, you know, how can we make our product more attractive? And one of the ways to do that is to kind of attach it to a story world, attach it to a famous text, attach it to a celebrity. And all of these processes and practices get, you know, mixed together and really become this very open-ended and really kind of widespread cultural practice in the 19th century and beyond.
That's really fascinating. Thank you. So before we finish up, are you working on any new projects at the moment? Do you have anything new in the works? And what can you tell us about any upcoming projects that you might have?
Yeah, I always have too many projects, but I am working on a few projects that are very much tied to both the interests in 19th century and adaptation. So I'm currently working with a colleague of mine who's at the University of Central Arkansas. His name is Glenn Jelinek. We are co-editing a collection that is called Adaptation Before Cinema. And we have a broader historical scope for that piece. So we have some examples from the medieval and early modern period, and then also 18th and 19th century examples. So that's an edited collection that we are currently working on with, we have 13 contributors for that. I am working on another thing that I do, and it's very much grounded in adaptation, is I work on a professional development program for K-12 educators that's about ways of strategizing how to use adaptation in the K-12 classroom. And that is an NEH-funded summer institute that was supposed to be held in 2020, but is now postponed for 2021 because so many things have done. And I do that with a colleague here of mine at the University of Arkansas, Sean Connors, who is in English education. This has been an incredibly productive collaboration that we do. And we're really hoping that other people will think about doing these ongoing professional development programs, because it's a way of bringing the research that we do in the academy to a wider audience. I'm also working on my own individual, my next book project individually is actually a transmedia cultural history of The Bride of Frankenstein. So I'm in the early stages of that project, but it's coming along. I'm really, really excited about this project. I've talked to a few people, and one of the things I think is really exciting is when I say, it's like, oh, I'm working on a book about The Bride of Frankenstein. They're like, oh, you mean the movie? I'm like, no, well, the movie will be in it. I mean the figure, the character. Yeah. And they're like, but she doesn't exist. I'm like, but she does. She exists in so many ways. And nobody's written a book about this. And so I am writing a book about this, and I'm very excited to do it because it's a book that actually shows the power of adaptation. She is a figure as a character. She's a figure that is completely created through adaptation, because she's only an idea in Shelley's novel. And so I just find that really exciting. And it's something that's, it's bringing my interest in adaptation and the 19th century, but it's bringing it more into a present moment, because so many of these, you know, all of these adaptations of The Bride of Frankenstein figure are, you know, from 1935 on. So that's my big next solo project. The last thing I kind of want to mention is that one of the things that has been really central to my my understanding about adaptation is like, I don't just look at this as a scholar, but I have the fortune, I don't look at this just as a scholar. I have the fortune of being married to an artist. So I'm married to a poet. His name is Jeffrey Davis. And he has really encouraged me to kind of think about this as artistic practice. And so I'm very fortunate, you know, through my connection with him and all of his connections, to really see so many artists working on adaptations of their own. Increasingly, I get more creative writing students in my adaptation classes because they're interested in kind of thinking about adaptation as a creative process, not just like a critical approach to it. And so that has inspired me too to do some of my own creative work. And so I've actually started working on some of my own adaptations, specifically of Frankenstein, but I have a complicated personal medical history, and I'm actually a 2-time cancer survivor. And this story is one that is very much part of the contemporary medical landscape. And so I'm working on some of my own creative writing, kind of working through these ideas about what it means to really survive in a world that often is, you know, the odds are against you. And so I have a kind of a special place in my heart for the Frankenstein story, not just as a scholar, but as, you know, as a survivor and someone who is really thinking about how can we really make stories our own, and how does kind of leaning on an existing story help you work through your own traumas, your own existence and survival. So those are, I have a lot of projects, hopefully, but they all come back to this idea, right? The 19th century works and adaptation are just so central to my work across the board. And so, but there's so many variations on it. And yeah, that's what I'm trying to do.
That sounds like such an interesting project. It really does sound fascinating. So just as we're closing up today, I'd like to thank Lizette again for being a guest on the show. Her book, Transmedia Adaptation in the 19th Century, is out now from Ohio State University Press, and you can purchase a copy from their website and from all good online retailers. So thanks again, Lizette, and I am so looking forward to your upcoming project on The Bride of Frankenstein as well. I love that character, so I'm just fascinated. So thanks again, Lizette, and thank you to our audience for tuning in. And you can find more podcasts on a host of different books over at the New Books website right now.